أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وبه نستعين، إنه خير ناصر ومعين. ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. My respected elders, brothers, sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. For the safety of all the Zuwar, for the safety of all the Shia and all the Muslimin and all those who are people of truth and justice, and for the safety and reappearance, the hasty reappearance of the Imam of our time, and for the special attention of our Imam towards this gathering of sincerity and intent on learning and purification, please recite a loud salawat. The topic that we have been covering over the course of this series has been something which inshallah has given us insight as to the perspective of the Ahlul Bayt on us being here, living here in a society which is predominantly non-Muslim. And what we've learned over the course of the evenings and the lectures has been specific guidance and specific expectations that the Ahlul Bayt have given us with respect to our situation. Last night we began to cover a very important piece of advice that we have from them, which had to do with giving life to the cause of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. And we talked last night about how this involves an understanding of the religion in its complete sense, including the vision and the mission that we have of establishing a just society, of individuals who themselves have established justice within and have reached that station of ubudiyyah and servitude to Allah. And we talked about how this involves the practical step of having a life, being a lifelong student of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, and we talked about how that's something which applies to all of us and there are no exceptions to that. What I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to look a little bit closer at that tradition and in particular the last portion of it. If you remember, the tradition is, in that tradition we see that the Imam alayhi salam is telling Hamad that if you were to follow my instructions, if you go to these lands and you are a source for guiding others by giving life to our cause, then when you die there, you will be raised as an ummah by yourself. That's the reward that's waiting for you. And we see that this is something that's reflected in other traditions as well too. In history, there was a certain point of time when our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he dispatches a contingent to the land of Yemen. And the leader of this contingent is Imam Ali alayhi salam. When he is about to go to this land, this land is a land which is predominantly non-Muslim, and there are many Christians who live there. He is seeking advice from the Prophet about how he should operate in that society. It's very relevant for us. What he tells him is that, "O Ali, do not fight anyone until you invite him to Islam." What we can gain from that is that our initial approach should not be antagonistic. The Prophet goes on to explain, "I swear by God, if Allah were to guide someone on account of your efforts, it would be better for you than everything on which the sun rises and sets." This is another example of the Prophet encouraging us being here, telling us that we have a mission. This, he's telling it to Imam Ali, but this is something which applies to us as well. We have a mission to uphold and to convey the cause of the Ahlul Bayt to others. And the reward for doing so is enormous. When in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, we see them talking about a reward which is greater than what the sun sets on, what it rises and sets on, what it means is that the reward is something which is cannot be described in material terms. Because the sun sets on material things, the land, anything that you can imagine that has a three-dimensional form and has matter to it. But the reward that that waits for somebody who is able to guide one among the non-Muslims to the cause of the Ahlul Bayt is something which can't even be put into any physical sort of dimension. What I'd like to, inshallah, cover tonight is a little bit more about how we can do this. Now that we have this enormous mission, what is it that we can do to actually practically take steps to do this in the way that the Ahlul Bayt have told us? One of the things that we gain from this particular theme that we find in the traditions is that we have a religion, brothers and sisters, which is a religion which is alive. And we have a responsibility for keeping it alive as well. Having a religion, a creed which is alive, gives us life as well. And this is a very important thing, that we should be inspired by the creed of Shia Islam. When we see that this is a religion which is going to take humanity towards perfection, that gives us energy on a day-to-day basis. What do I mean by that? Last night we talked about this to some extent, but I want to further this. Because sometimes people get the wrong idea. It's not that we're asking, or we're saying, well, the advice that we're getting, the guidance that we're getting from this is not that somehow we have to abandon everything that we're doing. But rather, what we already are doing, when we take this and take it to our hearts and apply this, and act on the spirit, the way that we do what we do is going to change fundamentally. For example, many of you are students in school. You go to university, you go to college, you're in secondary school, you're studying. The quality of studies of one who understands that he or she is part of the cause of the Ahlul Bayt will differ from one who doesn't have that mission. Because their goal is something which is far more lofty than anybody else out there. They understand that they have a role to play. When the Imam of the time comes, he's going to need experts in all fields. Number one. Number two is that in order to create a just society, we need justice in all areas, in all walks of life, which means that we need experts in every single field. Number three is that when people look at me, they judge me to some extent by my academic accomplishments. And so I have a responsibility as a flag bearer of this great cause and this mission to hold that flag in the best way possible. That's why we see in the seerah of those who truly upheld the cause of the Ahlul Bayt, we see them that when it came to their academic studies, they used to do them in the best way possible. One of the best examples we have is of somebody named Shahid Beheshti. Shahid Beheshti was somebody who was incredibly instrumental in bringing about the Islamic Revolution. And unfortunately, he was martyred. He wasn't able to be part of the movement afterwards. But his thoughts were instrumental in bringing about a change in the society. One of the things we know about him is that he was extremely devout when it came to his studies in all different areas. One time they say that he wanted to learn about economics. And he found some university professors. He was in the Hausa. He found some university professors who were willing to meet with him on a weekly basis. He would exchange his viewpoints from the Islamic studies that he had performed about economics, and they would give him their viewpoints about economics from their backgrounds. They were economics professors. They started having weekly sessions, and they say that, according to history, it says that what happened is that these professors, when they started discussing with him, they realized that he already knew most of what they had to offer. But they had nothing and very little knowledge about what he had to offer. And so what ended up happening was that instead of it being a discussion circle, it turned out to be something where he would teach the university professors. Meaning that whatever he applied himself to when it came to economics, when it came to other fields as well too, he knew English as well too, he knew German, he knew French, whatever it was, he would take it seriously and learn it the best way possible. A practical example, I was speaking to a young man, not in this community, in another community, and he was telling me that, look, I'm in a situation right now where I could stop pursuing my line, my field, and I could make a very good salary and be comfortable in my life. But when I look around in the community, I see that there are a lot of people who are already doing the same thing that I'm doing. But there's very few people who have gone further and gotten to that point where they're influential within the university circle, where they can set policy. And I've realized that that's something that I can do. I have that ability within me. And so I'm going to sacrifice a little bit, hold off on that, do more research, do more academics, spend a little bit more time. But in doing so, I'll be able to be influential then, and I'll be able to be a source of help to the community. This is an example of how being part of a mission which is alive affects the way that we study. It affects other areas of our life as well too. Another example is when it comes to interacting with our family members. Let me give you a tradition. Okay, this tradition is a very beautiful tradition. It is regarding somebody who has this spirit. Let me give you the scenario. Sometimes we do something for somebody else. For example, let's say we're married, or we do something for our spouse. Okay, we do so, and because we tend to sometimes lack sincerity, we tend to lack the presence of Allah in our lives, we expect something in return from them. And when we don't see it, we become disappointed. For example, let's say that my wife has to go out of the home, I spend some extra time cleaning up, I prepare something, I do something, she comes back and she doesn't even notice what I've done, or vice versa. Now usually what happens if that takes place one time, two times, then we get disappointed, and eventually it gets to the point where we express our disappointment and we stop doing that for our spouse. And you can apply this to other situations as well too. That's typical, but with somebody who has God in their lives, somebody who understands that we don't do things for the pleasure of human beings, we do things for the pleasure of God, their relationships are fundamentally transformed as well too. When we do something to make a fellow believer happy, we don't do so with any expectation that they're going to thank us, that they're going to praise us, that our name is going to be announced somewhere. No, we do it purely for the sake of God and because we're part of this mission. What is the tradition? That when one of you Shia, this is from the Imams, they say that when one of you, one of our followers, if you cause a fellow believer to be happy, then you should know that you're not just trying to make him happy. Bal wallahi alayna, you're making us happy. Bal wallahi ala rasulillahi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
so beautiful that when we try to make a believer happy, actually we're making the imam of our time happy, and we're making the prophet happy as well too. That type of understanding gives us energy. It gives us ability to deal with problems. Now, in this particular situation, if it's a case that it's repeated, then definitely, for example, in a marriage, we would need to bring it up with our spouse. But we would do so not out of spite, not out of hatred, not in a negative way, but rather in a positive way that, look it, I want to let you know that one of the things that I've noticed is that you don't tend to notice the good things that others do for you. And this is something that I'd like to help you work on. That's completely different than somebody who comes and says that, you didn't notice that, you didn't notice that, I'm not going to do anything for you from now on. Please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. These are some practical examples which tell us what it means to be alive and to be part of this mission of doing ihya of the amr of the Ahlul Bayt, that we're giving life to the cause of the Ahlul Bayt. Now, the question I'd like to address right now is a very important one, which is, how can we do so? How are we supposed to convey the cause of the Ahlul Bayt, the mission of the Ahlul Bayt, to others around us? The Ahlul Bayt have given us strategies in this regard. It's not up to us to determine this. It's not our prerogative to say that, you know what, I need to make everyone a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, I'm going to make forge my own path of doing so. No, they've given us specific instructions in this regard. And these instructions come to us from the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. There's two primary means. Number one is through our actions, and number two is through our tongue. Now, before I talk about spreading the mission of the Ahlul Bayt through our actions, I just want to spend a moment on this topic of spreading Islam and the mission of the Ahlul Bayt with our tongues. What that means is, it goes back to the verse of the Quran. Allah tells us in the Quran, "Udu'u ila sabili rabbik bil hikmati wa maw'idatil hasana wa jadilhum billati hiya ahsan." Which means that you should call to the path of your Lord with wisdom and with spiritual advice that hits the heart. And if you wish to dispute, then you do so in the best way possible. This is part of what we have to do. We have to be engaging with other communities, but using the best way possible. We have to be presenting the truth. We have to be defending the principles of Islam and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And we see that in the time of our Imams alayhi salam, they would train people specifically for this purpose, scholars from amongst their own circles, and they would tell them to go out, and this is your task to do so. That is a responsibility for those who are capable of doing so, but there's one responsibility which is for all of us, which is to call to the mission of the Ahlul Bayt through our actions and through our character. There's a number of traditions that convey this to us. For example, one of them says this, that kunu du'atan lin-nasi bighayri al-sanatikum, that you should call to the people without using your tongues. And I know that you've heard this before, right? But this is something that we need to be reminded about, and we need to go into it a little bit more deeper. Call to the people without using your tongues, so that they can see from you al-wara'a wal-ijtihada was-salata wal-khair, fa-inna dhalika da'iyatun. Let them see from you your commitment to God and to observing the halal and the haram. Let them see from you your commitment to worship and ibadah. Let them see from you your salat. And let them see from you goodness. And that itself will be a form of inviting others to the faith. In another tradition, we see them saying that, let them see from you your truthfulness. Let them see from you your honesty and your ability to take a trust and to keep it as well too. Now, the question I'd like to address is the following, which is that, why is it the case that by practicing the deen of Islam in its fullest way, meaning not just worship, but worship and the other things that come along with it, the way that we're supposed to interact with others, honesty, truthfulness, why is it that it's something that will attract other people to the mission of the Ahlul Bayt? Because it might be something which is not immediately obvious to us, that if I pray, what's the connection of my saying salat and bringing other people to the mission of the Ahlul Bayt. Please say salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, the discussion goes back to something called the fitrah. You see, we speak a common language with all other human beings in this universe, which is the language of the fitrah. We all are created in a certain way, that with an inclination to go to God. When somebody is a practicing believer, a practicing mu'min, putting all the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt to their best extent into practice, what happens is they become a reminder for others about where they come from and their original source and their original creation. Let me give you an example. Suppose that you go into a foreign country, you're just walking around the streets, and you spot somebody from the community, all right, or somebody who looks like they're from the community. Because, for example, let's say from the Khoja community, many of you are part of the Khoja community, there's a famous saying that we say that you can spot a Khoja from a mile away wherever you are. The way that they walk, the way that they look, you can know it from far away. Let's say you go to some foreign land like Guatemala or Timbuktu, and you see somebody and you're like, ah, okay, there he is. All right, by seeing that person, it transfers you to memories of where you come from and your origin. And maybe you go to them and you start talking about the past and you reminisce about how you used to be, you know, part of living together in some village and playing football together and drinking, soda from those bottles, etc., etc. Right? You remember the past by seeing somebody, it transfers you to that. This is an example. Now, let's take it to what we're talking about here. When we ourselves put the deen into practice, we become people who are devout in our worship and very much attentive to how we interact with others and applying the teachings of Islam when it comes to social interactions, we become a source for reminding other people about where they come from. When they see us, they're reminded about something. They're like, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, that's something familiar about that person right there. It reminds me of my purpose in life. There's a very beautiful example I'd like to share with you. This is from the poetry of Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi. You've heard of Rumi before. Rumi, usually sometimes in the culture that we're in, he's thought of as being somebody who is a poet of love. And they use his poetry, and sometimes they say that he's talking about how to romance another human being. But actually, people like Rumi were scholars of Islam. And when they would write their poetry, they would talk about the themes of the Quran and of the traditions of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, and they would put them into the form of poetry. In his first poem, it's a very famous poem, perhaps you've heard of it. It's his first poem in his work called the Mathnawi. What does he say? It's very beautiful. He says, and I'll say the Farsi and then I'll translate it into English. He says, Bashno az ne chun hekayat mikunad, az judaiha shekayat mikunad. It's for those of you who have an appreciation for the Persian language, you'll note that this is some of the most beautiful poems and poetry that has been written. Listen to the reed flute, how it is complaining. It is telling about separations. Now, what the story is the following, that when you want to make a flute, one of the ways you can make a flute, the kind that when you blow into it, it makes a very sad and mournful tune, you can take a reed, you know what a reed is, right? You can take a reed, you pluck it out from a bank of reeds, and you turn it into a flute. You wrap it up and you make it into something which is hollow and it becomes a flute. Okay? Now he's telling a story. It's an example here. Don't say that Brother Singh is talking about a flute and maybe there's gonna be haram music involved or something. Maybe you shouldn't listen. No, this is an example. Okay, it's a parable. He's saying that come and hear the story and the song of this flute. The flute is complaining about something. That mournful tune that is coming from it, it's complaining. It's telling us about separations. Ever since I was severed from the reed field, men and women have lamented in the presence of my shrill cries. Because when that melody is played, it's a very sad melody, and people can cry when they hear it. But I want a heart. I don't want them to cry about that, right? I want a heart which is torn from separation, so that I may explain the pain of yearning. This is the point. Anyone who has remained far from his roots seeks a return to the time of his union. Brothers and sisters, we have something in common with every human being out there. We all come from the same source, and we are actually yearning to go back to it. Every human being out there, whoever they are, they're actually yearning for the path which will take them back to their roots. Some of them are busy, just like the people who are busy listening to that song of the flute, they're busy there. But there are some whose hearts are yearning for something more, and they're waiting for that to come. And we have what it is to offer to them, whoever they are. And we can remind them that we all come from that same reed bed. We all come from the same source. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. This is what we have to offer, and the best way of doing so is by being a source for them to be reminded of that automatically. We don't even have to try. It's not about what we say. It's about the way that we are. If we take these teachings and apply them, that salat that we perform, it has profound effects. Sometimes we shortchange this. We're like, oh, just a salat, right? I'm just like the other guy in the street, but I do salat. No. That salat that we do is powerful, brothers and sisters. Let me tell you a story. Okay, this is a story of somebody named Ayatollah Kashi. Ayatollah Kashi is famous, right? He's famous for a lot of stories about how powerful of an arif he was, and how he was somebody who was inspiring to so many other people. One of the things that's famous about him is the way that he would do his salat, right? He really felt his prayer. And what we're told by students who used to live in the same school that where he used to teach, that there's one story that says the following, that one time this one young student, he wakes up in the morning to perform his Salatul Layl, Namaz al-Shab. And he goes to perform his wudu, and he sees that the entire world around him is busy in the dhikr of Allah. And he describes it by saying the following, that on one hand everything is silent, on the other hand everything is doing dhikr of Allah. Even the room where I'm performing the wudu, that room as well too is performing the dhikr of Allah. He says, I go to the open space in the courtyard of the school, and I see that Ayatollah Kashi is standing there, and he's engaged in prayer, and he's saying Subuhun Quddus Rabbul Malaikati Warruh. And it's as if the entire courtyard is responding with him, saying Subuhun Quddus Rabbul Malaikati Warruh. And he says, I stood there enraptured by this scene until Ayatollah Kashi finished his Salatul Layl. And he sits down and he gets ready to perform the Salatul Fajr. And that's when this vision stops. I went back, he says, to my room. I performed my Salatul Fajr, and the next day I had an opportunity to meet with him. And I said, can I get some time with you? He says, yeah. He says, I went to him and I said that when I woke up in the morning, this is what happened to me. And I saw that this was directly related to your Salat. That this is because of what you were doing in Salat, that everything was doing dhikr around you. So he tells him that, number one, he says that Allah blessed you so that you could see that reality that was being displayed. But number two, don't tell anybody else about this either. Keep it to yourself. This is just an example, brothers and sisters. Now, we might not be subject to such visions, but this isn't just one story. We have other examples as well too, of that our commitment to the deen itself is a powerful form of bringing others to it. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, part of this, brothers and sisters, is a very important point, which is that when we call people to the deen, we should do so in a way that we don't repel them from it, which is obvious. Okay, we have a responsibility to give life to this religion, not to make it die. And what that means is that we have to understand that we have a responsibility in this regard. Especially when we're in this society and we're amongst non-Muslims, we have to be very careful not to do anything to present the deen in a way which weakens it. What I'd like to do is to address this particular issue. And it's a controversial issue. I just want to say from right now that it's a controversial issue. But I don't want anybody to get upset, because I'm going to try to address it in an academic sort of way. And it has to do with this issue of, it's called different things in Farsi, it's called Qamazani, in Urdu, it's called Zanjir Matam, and whatever, you know what the topic is. It's the idea of doing matam and doing it in a way that that blood is shed. Okay, now, this is I know that it's been talked about before, but what I want to do is address it from this perspective, from that point that we're talking about, which is that we have a responsibility. God forbid that we should fail in this responsibility, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Now, point number one is that our commemoration of the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein and those acts that we do to commemorate that, to cry over it, to grieve over it, these are of supreme importance. And this is part of the mission of upholding, this is part of what it takes to uphold and give life to the mission of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. This itself is one of our responsibilities, to tell people of the tragedy, to tell them and use it as a means of explaining how humanity, how evil and cruel humanity can go, and how we need to have justice, and we need to have the symbol of justice and the leader of justice as well too, and the other great teachings that we have from the tragedy of Karbala. This is of supreme importance, number one. Number two is that we have to do so not just through an academic way, but through an emotional way as well too, by grieving, by crying, by expressing our emotion. When it comes to other deaths, like the death of a family member, we're told that we should keep it limited. We're not supposed to grieve in an excessive sort of way. But when it comes to the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, we're told that no. Here, we're supposed to grieve at the highest level possible, in the most expressive way possible as well too. But with some parameters. What are the parameters? Number one is that, and this is, I'm speaking from perspective of all maraj. Number one is that we cannot cause excessive harm to our bodies. And this is obvious, we don't need to go into why that's there. Number two is that what we're doing should be an expression of grief in the society that we're living in. It should be the case that somebody who sees us grieving should, this thought should come to the mind that, wow, there must be something very, very powerful that took place that would make him or her that upset and that sad that this is how they're expressing their grief. This is the type of grief that we need to be expressing. It should be an expression of grief. And number three is that what we do should not cause what is called wahan to the deen of Islam and to the madhab of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. This is from all maraji. Right? There's nothing controversial about this. The third point is what I want to focus on, because this is something that I think hasn't necessarily been understood or explained in a clear way. What does wahan mean? Wahan means weakness. All maraja tell us that we, in commemorating and mourning, we should not do so in a way that weakens Islam or weakens the cause of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Now, what does it mean to weaken the religion of Islam? Right, this is something which is pretty obvious, it's pretty simple, but let me just give you a tradition from the Ahlul Bayt. What they tell us is the following: Kunu habibuna ila nas wa la tubaghiduna ilayhim. Your responsibility is to make us beloved to the people. Do not cause people to hate us. Okay, very simple, very straightforward. That you don't have the right to cause people to view the Ahlul Bayt or their creed or their religion or the religion of Islam in a way which people hate it, they detest it, in a way that it is weakened. Now, given that, now, inshallah, this is a brief sort of summary of the principle that we have, a brief summary of the law. Now, this is something that we can apply ourselves when it comes to the issue of blood matam. is it something that in this society that we're living in, is it going to cause the religion of Islam to be seen in a weak, would it be weakened in the eyes of people or not? This is something that you can, inshallah, come to the conclusion. If you need to discuss it with other people, then do so. Talk to people who understand the society, who understand these rules, and see. But it's not so difficult to come to a conclusion. But just keep in mind one thing, that when it comes to this particular point, if we have marajit, even if we don't do taqlid of these marajit, if we do have marajit who have told us that this is the rule, and by the way, according to our opinion, which is an expert opinion, based on our understanding of the society, that this particular act is causing weakness in the eyes of people. People are seeing the religion in a weaker way. If they're saying that, then we have to take that into account and be very, very sure that they are all wrong if we want to do something to the contrary. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The last point I'd like to make, brothers and sisters, in this regard, inshallah, then move to the musibat portion, is that when it comes to this responsibility that we have of mourning, we need to take it seriously and really embrace it and feel that this is a responsibility for us. For example, matam. Okay, the matam that we do is an act of mourning. And it should be, and it can be. It should be the case that people, when they see us doing this matam, they're thinking that, wow, this is something that really is powerful, and it can be. It is an expression like that. But we need to work on it. And there's room to grow in this regard as well too. Sometimes when you see that people are not so much participating in the matam, we have to ask why. Is it the case that we don't understand why we're doing it? Well, we're doing it because it is an act of grieving. Okay, fine. Now, how is it that we can do it in a way that will attract people to the deen of Islam? This is something that we need to really think about. And we need to plan and strategize. If we see that other communities in the West have figured out how to do this in a way that everyone gets involved, everyone feels that this is something that is we have to participate in, we can't miss out on this. They feel saddened when they participate, they really get into it, then we need to see what we can borrow from them as well too. We have a lot of talent in our communities. Let us take that and apply it and see what we can do. We've done a lot of work, but definitely there's room to grow. And all of us need to participate in this. It shouldn't be the case that our kind of withdrawing and not really getting into it becomes a cause of weakening the mission. It's a responsibility that we have. And we need to go and re-examine the instructions of the Ahlul Bayt in this regard as well too. Let me end with this tradition. I know that you probably have heard it before, but it's good to remind ourselves about it and analyze it further. The story goes the following, that there was a time when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, sallu ala Muhammad, when our Imam alayhi salam was visited by the famous poet Da'bil. Now, Da'bil was somebody who was a poet of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. He wishes for him to say some poetry in commemoration of what took place in Karbala. Now, what's very interesting is the way that he goes about doing so, the strategy that he takes. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam doesn't say that, okay, just come in and start reading your poetry. No, he creates the ground for doing so. What does he do? He first of all quotes some traditions about the importance of crying and causing other people to cry and weep over the tragedy. Well, we can learn from that. We need to make use of these traditions. We need to share them and maybe say them before we actually begin. And then what does he do then? He puts up a curtain and he calls his family in to sit behind the curtain so that when they're crying, it will enhance the experience of everyone involved. Again, that gives us a lesson there, that when it comes to putting on these mourning ceremonies, we have to plan for them. We have to see what we can do to maximize that impact of mourning and grieving. And then look at the way that Da'bil takes on this responsibility. He doesn't say, okay, Bismillah, let me start. Okay, start the poetry. No. He prepares himself for doing so. And all of my budding Noha Khans, and alhamdulillah, we have a lot of talent in this community. Inshallah, you can take a message from this. What does he do? the tradition says that فَاسْتَعَبَرْتُ وَسَالَتْ عَبْرَتِي. He says that first of all, I sought tears. I look for tears to come to my eyes. And it got to the point when tears started flowing down from my eyes, and that's when I began my poetry. Now, it shows us that, number one, the importance of trying to be emotional, and this, by the way, applies to other things as well, too, including the du'as that we recite. Number two is that it shows us the purity of the soul of the abil, that when he wants to, he can cry and shed tears for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. That's something which is a skill that we need to work on, right? It's a test for us to see how much room do we have to work on when it comes to our relationship with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Can I just sit there and cause tears to come to my eyes? Tears are flowing down his eyes, and then he begins to recite. What does he say? أَفَاطِمُ لَوْ خِلْتِ الْحُسَيْنَ مُجَدَّلًا. SubhanAllah, look at the way he says it. First of all, he says, and he addresses Bibi Fatima alayhi salam. We need to bring Bibi Fatima into our poetry. Oh Fatima, if only you were there and you could see Hussein sprawled on the ground. وَقَدْ مَاتَ أَثْشَانًا بِشَتِّي فُرَاتِ. And he has died, and he has been killed at the banks of the Euphrates, thirsty. إِذَنْ لَلَطَمْتِ الْخَدَّ فَاطِمُ عِنْدَهُ وَأَجْرَيْتِ دَمْعَ الْعَيْنِ فِي الْوَجَنَاتِ. If you were to see that, then you would indeed strike your thighs out of grief, and your tears would flow down your cheeks. أَفَاطِمُ قُومِ يَبْنَةَ الْخَيْرِ. O Fatima, the daughter of goodness, stand up. وَنْدُبِي نُجُومَ السَّمَاوَاتٍ بِأَرْضِ فَلَاتِ. And mourn over the stars from the sky that have fallen down into the desert ground. We pray to Allah to give us that inspiration to uphold the mission of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, to make it alive and not make it die, to understand our responsibilities to Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and to be able to call to people with our actions and with our tongue. Tonight, brothers and sisters, for the Masaib portion, I'd like to mention a very important connection, which is the connection of Imam Hussein and the Qur'an. What we're told is that Imam Hussein, from his childhood, had a very strong connection with the Qur'an. Whenever he would travel, whatever situation he'd be in, he'd be reading the Qur'an, quoting from the Qur'an. When he wants to guide people, he's the Imam, he does so by means of the Qur'an and the verses of the Qur'an. Even on the day of Ashura, we see so many times that Imam Hussein quotes from the Qur'an. He tells people that, don't you know that I am the one who is the Imam, and this is the Qur'an, and the Qur'an is the one that speaks about us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. He calls people to judge them based on the Qur'an as well too. Even after his death, Imam Hussein alayhi salam doesn't separate from the Qur'an. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. أيها المقتول بكربلاء عطشانا. Peace and blessings be upon you, O Abu Abdullah al-Husayn, the one who was slain on the banks of the Euphrates River with his mouth thirsty. What a scene in the streets of Kufa. Everyone has left aside whatever they're doing to gather around. What is it that's so interesting to them? What is it that they're gazing at? They're seeing the head atop the spear. What is the head saying? The head is reciting from the Qur'an. أَمْ حَسِبْتَ أَنَّ أَصْحَابَ الْكَهْفِ وَالرَّقِيمِ كَانُوا مِنْ آيَاتِنَا عَجَبًا. Do you consider the people of the cave and Raqim to be among our
signs that are wondrous. The head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam has not separated from the Quran. He is reading from the Quran until he tells the people, وَلَا تَزِدِ الظَّالِمِينَ إِلَّا ضَلَالًا. They don't know what to do. They see this head filled with light. Light is streaming to the heavens. Imam Hussein alayhi salam never was separated from the Quran. One of those who is standing tells us that there was a man there who could stand it no longer. What does he do? He takes up his whip. He wants to put silence to this head. He starts whipping the head of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein until it becomes silent. This same Imam alayhi salam is subject to abuse even after he has died. We're told that one of the companions is sitting in the court of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. He sees that the head of Imam Hussein is brought in. Ubaydullah takes his cane and he starts poking at the mouth of Abu Abdullah. The man says to him, Zayd ibn Arqam says that, how can you do so? These are the same lips that I saw the Messenger of Allah was kissing when he was a young boy. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimeen. Wa say'alamu al-ladhina zalamu ayyamun qalibin yunqalibun.